All right, continuing our series on the spiritual side of the American Revolution, which is never taught in any public school, and unfortunately sometimes not even in a lot of the private schools, people say, well, where do you get this information? Well, what you have to do is you have to go back to the historians who were writing back in the 1800s. They were much closer to the events, and they had no political agenda to put a spin on it. As I mentioned to you last week, George Washington is being sanitized clear out of a lot of the modern history books. You know why people don't want to talk about George? Because there's overwhelming evidence of his spirituality and what a godly man he really was. And we can't have that. That won't work well in a progressive atheistic society. And so we have to see what we can do to eliminate a lot of these facts and personalities from that great period of time. Well, we've talked about we've talked about Lexington, we've talked about Concord, we've talked about Bunker Hill, and those are all events that led up to the Declaration of Independence. I suppose most Americans have heard about the Declaration of Independence, but few know anything about it, and very few have ever read it. And it won't take you that long to read it. It's not actually that long. In fact, I timed myself. I read it fairly slowly this afternoon in about 6 minutes. You know, I wasn't even trying to speed read. I just kind of went through it, you know, about 6 minutes. It took me to read it. Well, about that time, you know, July 4th, 1776, rewind just a little bit, mid-June, Thomas Jefferson, at the insistence of John Adams, who was 8 years his senior, began to sit down and actually frame the Declaration of Independence. He worked at it night and day for 2 weeks, despite suffering from intense migraine headaches during that entire time. But he labored and he worked. And when you really read that document, it is absolutely a classic. You know, I believe the only book that God inspired is this book right here, the Word of God. But there are a few other documents in history that you have to think God must have had his hand in. You know, he may not have inspired them the way we think of the verbal inspiration of the scripture, but boy, you got to think, boy, the Lord must have been real close to that operation right there. And I think the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution are two of those, along with the Magna Carta and a few others that have come down. Jefferson said this, "I did not consider it as any part of my charge to invent new ideas." That wasn't his purpose. He wasn't trying to invent anything new. He was just trying to firmly establish what was already put down in black and white. So the Declaration starts this way. If you're not familiar with it, I'm just going to read you the first couple sentences. "When in the course of human events..." And there are courses of human events, are there not? "It becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitles them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation." Makes perfect sense. If we're going to separate from the political bands of Great Britain, then we are obligated to list the reasons why. That's all he's saying right there. It's incumbent upon us to tell everyone in the world why we are separating. Well, as Congress, the Continental Congress, began to deliberate over this parchment and this theme of separation from Great Britain, there was a great Scottish preacher. His name was Dr. John Witherspoon. Now, I've talked to you about the president of Harvard and some of the prayers that he offered during the Revolution. We've discussed those already. This guy was president of Princeton. It wasn't called Princeton then. It was called the College of New Jersey. But that today is Princeton University. You know, again, I emphasize, most of the Ivy League schools were started for the primary purpose of training preachers, not philosophers and atheists. Things have changed, haven't they? Well, Dr. John Witherspoon, he said this, quote, the country was not only ripe for independence, but in danger of becoming rotten for lack of it. Wow, that's quite a, that's a profound thought. Well, the justification for Dr. Witherspoon's words became very pronounced in Jefferson's writings in the Declaration of Independence. He went on to say, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights." Now, this is the second time he's mentioned God, the God of nature, and now by their Creator. So, in the opinion of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, who gives the rights? Not government, but God. Your rights come from God. And if you allow any human entity to assume the role and the position of giving you your rights, you've caved. You're in trouble. See? Only a real Bible believer comes to the conclusion that rights are granted only by God. You know, you got to be a Bible believer to come to that that conclusion. So, certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. It's the governed who allow the government to protect those rights. That's the job of government. Not to issue them, not to take them away, but to protect them. God-given rights. All right. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. All right, now, the courageous placing of blame, if we can say it that way, where it belonged was precisely what Patrick Henry meant when he said this, quote, "Government is a conditional compact between king and people. Violation of the covenant by either party discharges the other from obligation." Now, that's just common sense in legalese, isn't it? If one party violates the contract, then the other party is no longer obligated to fulfill the contract. Hey, I'm not going there yet, but maybe I will someday. Basic contract law. So that's what Patrick Henry has given him. Basic contract law. That's good. Well, you know, the Americans, what they really wanted at that point, they simply desired to go right on living as Englishmen under the blessings of British common law, as prescribed by the British Constitution. They had no desire for revolution, but what they were sensing and observing and being victims of was a lot of, as they said, usurpations and tyranny that was not being put upon the English people themselves, but as colonists. You see, they were being subjected to a lot of bad things. Jefferson wrote, "The history of the present king of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states." So he winds up the indictment with this climactic pronouncement. He says, "These united colonies are, and of right, ought to be free and independent states, and they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown." And his final line was no less awe-inspiring than the first when he said, "And for the support of this declaration with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." And those guys that signed that meant it. We'll talk about the price some of them paid in a little while. They really meant it, you see. I don't know how many people you could find in Congress today that would sign anything like that and mean it. I just don't know. Well, this was all evolving in the month of June, 1776. Now, this is after Lexington, Concord, Bunker Hill. Things are really steaming up. You know, they're getting a little hot and heavy. So on the first day of July, Congress began its formal debate over Richard Henry Lee's resolution that the American states should declare their independence. Well, on that day, interestingly, it didn't take them months and weeks and years, and they took care of business fairly quickly. But they weren't voting in the dark of night either over a health bill. So 9 of the 13 colonies endorsed the resolution at the initial vote. First vote, 9 out of 13 said, we're in. Understanding that the final vote would be taken the next day, the session ended with the arrival of a dispatch from Washington that a British invasion was imminent. They had suspected that, but the word was now coming down that this is clear of what's going to happen. Well, on the following day, New York, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and South Carolina made the break with Britain official. So all 13 colonies on the 2nd of July said, all right, we affirm this declaration of independence. All right, now on the 3rd of July, 9,000 British soldiers landed on New York's Staten Island. On the 3rd of July. And on the 4th of July, the Declaration of Independence was formally adopted by Congress. That evening, the handwritten scribblings of Jefferson, defaced with several corrections, were transported to a printer. Anybody remember the name of the printer? No, it wasn't Franklin. A fellow by the name of John Dunlap. And for the document's first printing, which was known as Dunlap Broadside. Think about it. He broadsided him, man. Well, Congress ordered a very handsome engrossed parchment to be prepared for the delegates to sign. That work was done by one Timothy Matlack. On the 8th of July, the declaration was read by Colonel John North in the courtyard of Philadelphia's State House. It is significant that Samuel Adams observed, and here was his observation, quote, the people seem to recognize this resolution as though it were a decree promulgated from heaven. Now, with the returned enemy fleet, they just came into New York Harbor, the British, with 430 ships. 430 ships. 10 times the size of the one that they'd retreated with earlier. So only 115 miles away from Congress in Philadelphia, the prospects of heaven's endorsement was really welcome. So it was at that point where allegedly Ben Franklin said this, we must be unanimous. There must be no pulling different ways. We must all hang together. And Benjamin Franklin said, yes, we must all hang together, or most assuredly we shall hang separately. And so they found a sense of unity. Now the signers, I don't have the number on my notes, but as I recall, it was 56, wasn't it? 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence? All right, whatever it was, 54, 55, 56, I think 56, but anyway. Here's just a quick summary. 5 were captured by the British and tortured before they died. 12 had their homes ransacked and burned. 2 lost their sons in the war. Another had 2 sons captured. 9 either died from war wounds or from hardships suffered in the war. Carter Braxton of Virginia, a wealthy planter and trader, watched his ships being destroyed by the British Navy. He died impoverished. Thomas McKean had to keep himself and his family in hiding and lost all his possessions. The British destroyed the property of Francis Lewis and jailed his wife. She died a few months later. John Hancock, reported to be the richest man in all of America, had already proven his commitment by ordering a cannonade on occupied Boston, realizing that most of his commercial property would be destroyed. That's commitment. One of the signers paid a particularly high price for his fidelity. John Hart was a farmer and a congressional delegate from New Jersey. Known as Honest John Hart, he was also sympathetic to the plight of the Baptist, having donated a portion of his own land for the Baptist Church in Hopewell. As such, Hart was prepared to go the second mile for the cause of liberty. With his farm situated on the enemy's highway, the document before him loomed as a personal death warrant. Despite his age of nearly 60 years, he signed the Declaration of Independence only to become an immediate exile for his fellow countrymen. The approaching enemy compelled him to leave the bedside of his dying wife and his 13 loving children so as to flee into the forest for safety. He would never see any of them again. His home, mill, and crops were all destroyed. His children fled to the mountains themselves. His wife died from the stress. And for more than a year, this Baptist patriot lived in swamps and caves, with his most civilized shelter being an outhouse he shared with a dog. Learning of his wife's homegoing and the destruction of his property, he died from exhaustion and a broken heart. Those are the kind of people that signed the Declaration of Independence. It'd be difficult to find those kind of people today, wouldn't it? It would be, I'm not saying impossible, just difficult. Just difficult. Well, there's some other stories that I'm going to save for another time about some of those guys. Meanwhile, back in New York on the 12th of July, two British officers approached the American camp under a flag of truce. And they had a letter for Mr. Washington. Well, a Colonel Reed of the Continental Army said to the emissary, "Sir, we have no person in our army with that address." Sent him back. And he refused to accept the dispatch. So they sent another one entitled George Washington Esquire. They sent it back. This time, Admiral Howe sent a verbal request asking if Washington would be willing to receive his own adjutant general. The commander agreed, and on the 20th of July, the meeting lasted for 30 minutes. And the Lieutenant Colonel James Patterson repeatedly addressing Washington by the title of Excellency. The gist of Howe's message was to the colonists, "If you repent, then we'll let bygones be bygones and we'll pardon you." And Washington said, probably in better terms than I know, essentially, "Hit the road. Eat a brick. You know, nuts." Yeah, famous World War II saying, nuts. Yeah, well, so now we come down to Long Island. This is events leading up to it. The assault finally came on the 27th of August, 1776. Howe's generals outflanked Washington's outnumbered troops, and they were horribly outnumbered, see. And a terrible slaughter took place, with America's losses that put over 1,000. Now, here's something very few history books will even refer to, and you need to know this, because there's a battle that's going on in the stratosphere that few people understand, and only people with a spiritual bent and some kind of a comprehension of Ephesians chapter 6 can even grasp. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. You know the verses. All right, it was at this Long Island battle that Howe unleashed a new secret weapon. Here was the weapon. German mercenaries, known as Hessians. They were being paid $36 a month, which is pretty big money in those days. You know, the equivalent of $36 a month. Now, here's the part you probably don't know. Although George III, King George of England III, was born in London, both his father and grandfather had been reared in the heavily Catholic area of Hanover, Germany. The pro-Vatican George III found the Roman Catholic Frederick II of Germany, only too happy to send his murderous Hessians to fight against the American Protestants. And that was the gist of it right there. You see, let's do away with these Protestants. They're controlling that new country. A letter from a British officer describes the butchery of these foreign agents. He said, quote, "The Hessians and our brave Highlanders gave no quarter, and it was a fine sight to see them dispatch the rebels with their bayonets after we had surrendered them so that they could not resist." After they surrendered, laid down their arms, then the Germans went in and bayoneted them all. Good Catholic folks. See? You won't get that in the average history book. But that's a fact. All right. Washington, observing all of this from the heights above, solemnly eulogized, "Good God, what brave fellows I must lose this day." It broke his heart. Well, he had no choice. He was in trouble, being so vastly outnumbered. He had to fall back from his makeshift fort on Brooklyn Heights. And they were in danger of being totally surrounded by Admiral Howe and his troops. And if Howe brought up the fleet up the Hudson to position the fleet behind the Americans, then they could be absolutely annihilated. Crossfire, both directions, you see. And then additional problems were many of the Irish Americans had deserted under pressure of their Catholic priest. See, so most people don't know this, don't understand it, but there's lots and lots of history. Particularly, like I said, if you go back and read the guys who were writing about it back in the 1800s, they'll tell you to some extent this was a religious war. You know, most wars are. Most wars are religious wars. And this was no exception. If you understand what had gone on previous to that in Europe, you know that just about every war that had taken place for hundreds of years was a religious war of one kind or another. So, Howell could have undoubtedly annihilated the entire American army had he chosen to press his advantage at that point. You know what Washington did at that particular time? I'll tell you what he did. He rallied his officers together, not for a strategy meeting, but for a prayer meeting. And that's what they did. They went to prayer. And an immediate retreat was ordered despite the inclement weather. Well, the paranoid Howe, you remember, he's thinking back to Bunker Hill. And how so many of his troops got slaughtered at Bunker Hill. So he's kind of twiddling his thumbs a little bit. He doesn't want a repeat of that deal. And so the Lord's people are preparing for their own Red Sea miracle. A great historian of yesteryear, Collins, wrote this about it. And this was written clear back in the mid-1800s, early 1800s, as I recall. He said this: "The weather made it impossible to transport the army by boats from Long Island. A high northeast wind had been raging for 3 days, but nevertheless, Washington and his officers resolved to try during the night of August the 29th. When the main army got ready to start embarking, suddenly at 11 p.m., the wind died down, the water became very smooth. A gentle breeze sprung up from the south and southwest, which aided the boats in crossing the East River to Manhattan. The moonlight was fairly bright, and the ships of the enemy were very close by, but strange as it may seem, the Patriot Army was not discovered as they made their evacuation. It was a momentous task to get 9,000 men across the river, and it was obvious that the mission could not be completed before daylight. As daylight approached, a thick sea fog came rolling in and shrouded the British camp." Now, who would question the hand of God and intervene to save the American cause? Probably just a coincidence. Don't get too excited about this stuff. You'll become a nut. Well, as the war continued to drag on, the vastly outnumbered Continental Army saw God intervene with acts of nature time and time and time again. I'm not going to repeat all of them, but boy, there were a lot of interventions there. Finally, after being chased out of New York on September the 15th, Harlem Heights on October the 18th, and even Fort Washington on the east bank of the Hudson on November the 16th, the Lord once again did something fairly miraculous. Congress had decreed at that point, it looks like they're losing at every stage of the thing. They're just totally run out of New York by now, and that's where the British Army and Navy has just really congested themselves. So you know what they did? Congress decreed a solemn day of fasting and prayer and humiliation to implore divine intervention. Wouldn't that be refreshing to see something like that? The United States Congress, actually. And we have people today that are constantly screaming, separation of church and state. You think these guys really believe that? I don't think so, see? So by this time, Washington's army was down to 3,000 men, less than 10% of the enemy's strength. He's got 3,000 men, they got about 30-some thousand. But Washington knew and wrote and elaborated to his officers on the idea that man's extremities are God's opportunities. And one biblical reference or story that he utilized to remind them of that was, you tell me, what do you think? David and Goliath would be a good one, but that's not what he used. What was that? You can't remember? Out of thousands. That fellow's name that was in charge is Gideon. Yeah, old Gideon, remember that? They had thousands, and God said, too many. Put them to the test. Send them home. Still too many. Send them home. Gideon's finally down to 300 men, the Lord said, now. I can do something with 300 men because you won't get the glory. God says, I will. Say, I will. And so the Lord worked a miracle in the behalf of Gideon, did he not? What book in the Bible do you find that story? Less Fox News, more Bible. Judges. It's in the book of Judges, see? All right, so by this point, Washington crossed the Hudson into New Jersey and then crossed the Delaware into Pennsylvania. And the trail of his troops could be easily traced by blood in the snow. Desperate men were slaughtering cattle along the way, not just to eat, but so they could wrap their feet in the hides. They were in desperate condition. The British were so sure that the war was over that General Cornwallis put his baggage on a ship for England. But what he did not know was that Washington was headed for some boats himself. At 9 p.m. on Christmas night, Washington made his immortal crossing of the Delaware. Now, you've all seen pictures of it. You know, Washington standing on the bow of a boat, and it's an artist's perception, but nonetheless, I think it's a good one. And they're crossing the Delaware. Well, where are they going on Christmas night? To attack the Hessian garrison at Trenton, New Jersey. That's where they're going. And so once again, the Lord came through despite the horrendous weather conditions, described by one soldier as fearfully cold and raw. A loyalist Tory farmer spotted the approaching Americans and rushed to the Hessian colonel, a fellow by the name of Johann Rall, to inform him of the impending attack. Well, the Germans were celebrating Christmas to the extent that they were all falling down drunk. Germans are good at that. You know, they're known for that, right? Now, if you're a German, I hope you're exempt from that, see? Good. But, so, He was playing cards and drinking, and so he was told the commandant was too busy drinking and playing cards to be disturbed. So the frustrated Tory scribbled a note on a piece of paper and handed it to Rawls' host, one fellow by the name of Abraham Hunt, who went to the inebriated colonel and simply stuck it in his pocket on his vest. When the attack finally came and the colonel sobered up enough to realize what was going on, he looked at the note and said, "Too late." Too late. The battle lasted 90 minutes. Washington's men killed 23 of the enemy and captured over 1,000 prisoners, while suffering only 4 wounded of their own troops. Didn't lose one. 4 got wounded. Well, Trenton. I got a whole section here that I'm going to save for a separate lesson on chaplains. You really need to know about the chaplains that were in the Continental Army and how God utilized them and some of the individual stories that accompany those men. But that's going to be a whole lesson. I don't know about you. I find it absolutely fascinating. Some of the people that God used. And they came from a variety of denominations. About a third of them were Baptist. But some of them were Presbyterians and some of them were Congregationalists and et cetera, et cetera. Of course, when you say some of those denominational names, you have to understand that 240 years ago, they were a lot different than a lot of them are today. You know, there was a huge, huge difference. Well, that brings us to Valley Forge, enduring the winter at Valley Forge. And that's all Valley Forge really was just a great, horrible endurance run. There was one Baptist preacher, though, that I must at least briefly allude to, and I'll tell you more stories about him in a subsequent lesson. His name was John Gano, and he was the pastor of the First Baptist Church of New York City. And he had a special and profound influence on Washington. In his famous biography, The Life of George Washington, M.L. Weens shares the unforgettable account that a friend of generals named Potts experienced while walking through the snow of Valley Forge during the awful winter of 77. Now, this Potts fellow is a farmer that lives in the area. And he's out walking in the snow one night. And here is the exact quote by M.L. Weens in this biography about George Washington. He says, quote, "Treading his way along the venerable grove, suddenly he heard the sound of a human voice, which he advanced, increased on his ear, and at length became like the voice of one speaking much in earnest. As he approached the spot with a cautious step, whom should he behold in a dark natural bower of ancient oaks but the commander-in-chief of the American armies, on his knees at prayer. Motionless with surprise, friend Potts continued on the place till the general, having ended his devotions, arose, and with a countenance of angel serenity, retired to the headquarters. Friend Potts then went home, entered his parlor, called out to his wife, 'Sarah, my dear Sarah, all's well, all's well. George Washington will yet prevail.'" When he heard the man pray, he was convinced. All right, now, that story has led to the artist's conception of a picture we've had hanging in this church. Right over there where it says, "Good Shepherd," Washington kneeling in the woods in the snow in prayer. Remember that picture? That picture is based on that story right there. Well, prevail he did. It wasn't too long, and spring is coming, and there's a Frenchman that shows up and volunteers his services. His name is Gilbert du... Help me, honey. M-O-T-I-E-R. Montier. See, that looks... I mean, you know, French I do not do. Yeah, well, I did. I know what I was thinking of, Gilbert the Grape. Oh. Remember that story? Gilbert the Grape or Grape the Gilbert or whatever it was. I don't know. Well, this fellow was later known as Marquis de Lafayette. And Lafayette introduced a lot of French troops into the equation. And then another fellow came along that was a Prussian military veteran. His name was, be thankful you don't have a name like this, Baron Frederick Wilhelm Ludloff Gerhard Augustine von Steuben. I don't know what they called him for short. He rose to no higher of a rank than major in his old country, in their military, but Washington made him a major general, and he became particularly involved in training the recruits. A great trainer, a great DI, you know. He knew how to train the troops. We'll talk more about that in a little while. And in fact, one time he called to a translator and said, "These fellas won't do what I tell them. Come swear for me." Well, it was the observation of some that at that point, angels seemed to be directing the musket balls fired from American rifles, testifying to the intense rain of death pouring down upon his men from nearby treetops. See, the Americans quickly figured out that this European warfare is stupid. You know, we all line up in a straight line, and they line up in a straight line, and we go out about 50 yards from each other and shoot at each other. Yeah, that's dumb. And so they, you know, way back at Concord, you remember, they figured that out. And they said, "We're not doing that anymore." And so now they got snipers in trees. And here's what one British general said. Burgoyne, he said, General Burgoyne said, "There was seldom a minute's interval of smoke in any part of our line without officers being taken off by single shots." The order of the day was, shoot the officers. Shoot the officers. Pointing to a particular British general, the American commander Dan Morgan said to one of his best shots, "That gallant officer is General Fraser. I admire him, but it is necessary that he should die. Do your duty." Moments later, the general lay mortally wounded. Now, in addition to the French entering into the equation, in addition to other foreigners like Germans helping, not Hessians, but people that had immigrated to the country earlier, a number of recruits started to show up, sharpshooting Virginia Rangers, and Washington was blessed with all kinds of recruits that came from the backwoods of Pennsylvania and Virginia. Now, these were people that were used to making their living with a rifle. And they knew how to shoot. Now, the British were still shooting, for the most part, with a rifle that was often affectionately referred to by them as the old Brown Bess. Now, in fact, the Brown Bess wasn't a rifle. It was a musket. A musket is a smooth bore, see? And its accuracy is not very good. And the further you get away, the less accuracy there is. Now, a rifled gun, hence the name rifle, has rifling in the barrel. Those are grooves, you see. At first, they put straight grooves in them, and rifling goes back as far as the 1500s in Germany. German immigrants that came to America long before the Revolutionary War introduced rifling into American-made rifles, you see. Later, they learned how to spiral the rifling, which even increased the accuracy. Now, some of these fellas could shoot a 7-inch round target at 250 yards. Now, this is show and tell night, folks. No, I brought two of them. This is a modern muzzle loader. And now some of you, of course, you're way ahead of me, but some of you may not understand this. This is what we call a percussion cap. You put a little cap with a charge in it on that nipple right there. And when you squeeze the trigger, it comes down on the cap, it explodes, and ignites the powder inside the barrel, and boom. It's pretty much like shooting a modern rifle. You squeeze the trigger, bang, that's it. Now, this is, I've had this for a number of years. It's a fairly accurate gun, up to probably 150 yards. It's pretty dependable. 54 caliber, a lot of lead, and they're deadly. I've killed several big game animals with this thing, you know. But that's not what these boys had. They were behind the curve on this deal, you see. They were shooting something that was known later as the old Kentucky rifle, but before that, essentially the same rifle was known as the Pennsylvania rifle. Now, this is a flintlock. It took me a whole summer of shooting to learn how to shoot this. Because it messes with your brain. And here's why. This little thing right here, that little pan, is called a flash pan. Hence, you've heard the phrase, he's just a flash in the pan. Right? It's a flash pan. You put powder in there, and of course, you put powder down the barrel. You put the wadding around your ball, and you stuff it down against your powder, you know. And then when you squeeze the trigger, this flint comes against this object here, and prayerfully and hopefully, a spark flies down into the flash pan, ignites the powder in the flash pan, goes through a tiny little hole, and ignites the powder in the barrel. Now, you see, even though it's a kind of a split second, it's a delayed reaction. And the delayed reaction is enough that makes the brain say it didn't go off, and you flinch. Until you learn to hold through. See, you got to hold this thing steady. So it takes some mental discipline to learn how to shoot these things accurately. But you shoot it, maybe we'll get a spark. I don't know if we got one or not. I couldn't see. The spark flies down in there. Now, here's the advantage of this gun over that gun. Well, that has rifling. This has rifling. Distance. Now, I've tinkered with powder loads in that gun. You got to understand, black powder is relatively slow burning compared to modern smokeless powder. And so you can overload your gun and it won't do you any good. You can put a whole bunch of powder in there and most of the powder will blow out the end without ever being ignited before the ball is out, you see. So the longer the barrel, the more the powder you can put in there that you can actually utilize. That's why these things had such, this is a 41-inch barrel. Now I've tinkered with loads, about 80 grains is about what will work in there. Well, you know, you can overload it and sometimes you lose your accuracy. So about 80 grains. I load this with 120 grains. And it's, you know, I'm not going to say that I'm good at 250 yards like some of those boys were, but I've hit targets at 200 yards with it. So they did have a weapon of considerable accuracy that the British didn't. And so the Lord, I believe the Lord's involved in all that stuff. You know, it was the Lord that sent those German immigrants over years and years before that taught the Americans how to build these kind of rifles. And so they had them at their disposal. They'd practiced with them all their lives, and they were good. They were good at shooting them. And let me tell you something. This sucker's heavy. And I mean, to hold that thing out there and hold it steady, boy, that took some practice and talent. Because as long as that barrel is, as heavy as that is, just carrying it around, I've packed around hunting with this thing in the woods all day, and at the end of the day, you just say, good night. That's why I finally abdicated and bought a little short guy. But this is what they were utilizing, a gun just very, very similar to this thing right here. So they found an advantage, and all of a sudden the advantage began to swing to the Americans. General Burgoyne surrenders his entire army of 5,000 men to Washington at Saratoga on October the 9th, 1777. Most historians date this American victory as the turning point of the war. Quickly, just another story or two. In 1780, the thing drug on and lulled and went through its lulls and hills and valleys and all the rest of it. But in 1780, Cornwallis invaded the south part of the colonies with absolute untold, unbridled brutality, sparing neither age, sex, or infancy. Kill them all was the command. And when a force of volunteers from Virginia, Tennessee, and both Carolinas came to the rescue on October the 7th, they learned that a British major by the name of Patrick Ferguson was entrenched on top of South Carolina's King's Mountain, it was called, with an army of 1,100 regulars. Here's what Ferguson boasted. Be careful of your boast, Captain of the Titanic. Here's what Ferguson boasted. He said, quote, God Almighty himself could not drive me from this hill. What a fool. What a fool. Those volunteers that came from the backwoods of Virginia, Tennessee, and the Carolinas packing these things right here just sat way out there and just started picking them off and picking them off. 225 British were killed, 163 wounded, and 716 captured. The major tried to escape on horseback, the big coward, but he was riddled with lead. The American casualties consisted of 28 killed and 62 wounded. The end was drawing near. And all the time, Washington and his leadership is giving credit to God. With the additional disasters at Cowpens on January the 27th, Guilford Courthouse on March the 15th, Lord Cornwallis was licking his wounds at the seaport of Yorktown. Well, Washington returned to Yorktown with 2,000 Continentals and 12,000 Frenchmen. You know, if the Lord's in the thing, he'll provide all the help you need. I mean, we'll even take help from the French. honestly, in reality, folks, the help that the French rendered to the American Revolution may have been their brightest hour. You know, it just may have been. Because you know the old story, don't you? How many Frenchmen does it take to defend Paris? They don't know. It's never been tried. I told that joke in our church in Washington, and a French guy got real offended, and I had to remind him I've told many more Polack jokes than I have French jokes. Well, once again, nature's God would have the preeminence in the midst of Virginia's mid-autumn Indian summer. They're having Indian summer now, you know. You know how it is a lot of times in October, September. Weather just, that's my favorite time of the year. It's just gorgeous, you know, beautiful, and everything's nice. Well, they were having that same kind of thing, but Washington didn't need beautiful weather. He needed inclement weather. He needed bad weather. He needed rain. He needed some things so that he could move his cannon into position against the enemy, undetected. And so you know what he did? He assembled his officers once again. He said, we're going to prayer. Can you imagine? What a radical. I mean, what a radical. So he said, we're going to prayer. And sure enough, the Lord answered with unseasonable rain in the middle of Indian summer. enabling him to position his artillery close to the enemy. At approximately 5 p.m. on October the 9th, American soldiers ran up their flag, which they called by that time the Star-Spangled Banner. And George Washington personally fired the first cannon. Over 3,600 shells and mortars hit in the next 24 hours, the British. Dr. James Thatcher, an American surgeon, testified, quote, "All around was thunder and lightning from our numerous cannon and mortars, and the darkness of night presented one of the most sublime and magnificent spectacles which can be imagined. I have more than once witnessed fragments of the mangled bodies and limbs of the British soldiers thrown into the air by the bursting of our shells." On October the 16th, a desperate Cornwallis attempted to escape by night across the York River to Gloucester Point. However, Washington's God had other plans. You know how that goes. Henry Johnson, an acclaimed historian on the Yorktown campaign, says, quote, "It is possible that he could have succeeded, but the elements interposed to stop him. At midnight, a storm arose, preventing the crossing of all the troops, and at dawn, those who had already crossed returned to their old stations at the works, which were now crumbling away under the point-blank fire of the new batteries opened on the second parallel." So, at 10 a.m. on the 17th, Lord Cornwallis was shell-shocked, literally. So he requested a 24-hour truce to discuss surrender and capitulation. Washington said, "No, you get 2 hours. That's all you get, 2 hours. And so they tried to pull a fast one on him, but it didn't work. And so this was the beginning of the end. 6.5 years after British troops marched into Lexington toward Concord, you remember that's kind of where we started this, 7,247 bedraggled redcoats followed O'Hare with a disorderly and unsoldierly conduct. Their step was irregular and their ranks frequently broken as their own band played. Now, when they came to Lexington, you know what they were playing in mockery? In ridicule, they were playing Yankee Doodle Dandy. When they left, you know what their band was playing? The tune is called "The World Turned Upside Down." When they were ordered to stack their arms, some threw their weapons down, trying to damage them, and some hugged them in farewell. Well, here's the words to the tune that they were singing, or the band was playing. I don't know if they were singing it. "If ponies rode men, and if grass ate cows, and cats should be chased into holes by the mouse, if summer were spring and the other way around, then all the world would be upside down." It was that song that they played. Well, America's commander-in-chief knew who deserved the credit for all of these extraordinary events, and we've just kind of given you a very brief top of the iceberg summary of them. But he knew. Thatcher informs us that after Washington formally thanked his own men as well as the French troops, he turned everyone's attention heavenward. Having begun his war effort with an official directive to attend divine services, remember that? That's how he concluded. Quote, "He closed by ordering that divine service should be performed in the several brigades tomorrow and recommends that the troops attend with a serious deportment and with a sensibility of heart which the recollection of the surprising and particular interposition of Providence in our favor claims." Washington said, "We know who gave us the victory, and we're going to thank him for it. We're going to praise his name for it." Different days, different mentality, different thought pattern. You know what made the difference? The Word of God and its influence.